Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this week we bring together several of the most familiar voices from Culture File when we hear from Paddy Woodworth on The Naturalist Bookshelf. Orrit Gatt has been to see the latest Turner Prize shortlist at the Tate Britain in London. And Tige O'Sullivan is recalling a shocking 1980s school television experience. But before all that, Gorky goes global. Maxine Gorky's play Summer Folk premiered in St. Petersburg in 1904, as revolution was starting to loom on the horizon, overflowing with characters contemplating change, personal and societal, and wondering even if art might transform the world. Over a century later, and in another turbulent age, the Dublin-based theatre outfit Outlandish has assembled an international multi-generational cast, including Polina, a Russian poet living in Dublin 8, and Cork-based poet, performer and storyteller Neo Florence Gilson, to imagine their world through Gorky's play. Culture File's Rachel Andrews went to meet some of the Outlandish team.
When we assumed this role, we basically were told to explore the day in, you know, watchman's life. And for me, it was easier to kind of immediately think what to research on, because of where I am currently staying in direct provision. And also I was also visualizing the scenarios when we are in retail stores. We always have like the security guard. It's almost like everywhere we are always under surveillance. My name is Nell Florence Gilson, and I am a poet and a singer. My role in this piece, it's a role of a watchman, and my colleague Ingrid, she's also a watchman. Our participation, it's really that of observing what are the threats and opportunities that are presented to us while we are doing our jobs as watchmen, and also exploring the power dynamics and the limits to how we actually do our jobs. So we haven't got much autonomy or authority because we are hired, but in a subtle way, we also have power to enforce rules within our scope of practice. I met Morten and Benny came to where I was hosted when I arrived in Ireland. Actually, what happened was when I came back from lunch, there was like a note inside the door, and it was talking about workshops and, you know, like kind of like an outreach program that they were running, and I was like, yeah, something for me to do. And I went there with my baby. She was 9 months. That's how we met. Then it progressed to participating in the group WOW, Woman on Woman. They were reaching out to women from the refugee and migrant communities. I would gladly say that I have been under their ongoing mentorship since then.
My desire is peace. The least we could do is to remind ourselves and others that most wars are fought for the profit and benefit of the ruling class. It is rarely buried the war.
The groups that we work with, the people that we work with, we are all looking to see how society functions, how society operates, the kind of inequalities that we experience in our daily lives. My name is Fiona Bulger, and I work with Outlandish Theatre as an outreach artist. Global desires, it was both about personal desires and then the more for equality, for peace, more global, the larger desires. The production itself and emerged from both Dublin 8 and from Brasilia and from Cork and from Ghent in Belgium. So it's global in a sense, but it's also very local. Gorky was seeking to challenge violence in the world and the level of violence and to seek a world without violence. That idea and his search for a more peaceful world resonated with the kind of desires that we found in the groups class that we were working with.
It is rarely about the working class of country A hating the working class of country B and naming it harm in them. It's more often about fighting for the villas, areas of influence and capital of the elites.
One of the things that I really appreciate about Outlandish theatre, that they have magic in their hands to make things possible. Because for me, I was trying to think, how is it going to be possible to do this? And being in Cork and they are in Dublin, but we met every Wednesday, I think the past 2 years, on Zoom. Immediately there was a connection. There was distance was no longer a barrier. Art for me is a lifeline. It became not only a lifeline, but also kind of like an escapism for me to just briefly just travel from this present space into another space.
Some of the team behind Outlandish Theatre's Global Desires there, and the reporter was Rachel Andrews. Outlandish's Global Desires is at the Digital Hub Dublin to the 13th of October as part of Dublin Theatre Festival 2024. Now, what use is the Turner Prize for Contemporary Art? Plenty, decides our correspondent Orit Gat in her latest voice notes, gathered at this year's shortlist exhibition at Tate Britain in London.
They say there can only be one winner, but that's not actually true. In 2019, the four artists nominated for the Turner Prize, Helen Kamek, Lawrence Abouhamdan, Oscar Murillo, and Tai Shani, decided to share the award. They asked the judges not to choose a single winner, but to give it to them together. They are making a statement against division in a volatile time, and also a gesture responding to the infamy of the Turner Prize, how it created a cult of individuals around the artists who won it. In 2021, the prize was given to a collective, the Array Collective from Belfast, after only nominating four collectives. These are new attempts, but the Turner Prize is now 40 years old and often still associated with the YBAs, that group of London artists in the 90s that includes Damien Hirst, who won in 1995, showing two halves of a cow and a calf, each bisected and preserved in formaldehyde, and Tracy Emin. She didn't win, but won some fame for showing her bed, remnants of her youthful lifestyle stained into the sheets, in 1999. It's kind of fun to discuss the Turner Prize. The tabloids get involved. You can place a bet. There are endless mentions of controversies of awards past, like how Chris Ofili's paintings rested on dry elephant dung, how Tino Segal gave visitors to the museum £2 as part of his project, how David Shrigley is that artist who made a dead dog sculpture. For the record, it's a taxidermy dog holding a sign that says, "I'm dead," and it is pretty funny. This year, the newspapers once again have complaints. The Telegraph ran an article titled "From Buzzy to Box Ticking, How the Turner Prize Lost Its Way." At The Eye, critic Florence Hallett said that it was boring, pompous, and disgracefully narrow, and adds, "There's no question that Claudette Johnson must win, but how I wish she had some worthy competition." The bookies agree. They give Johnson 40% chance. At The Times, they say it's time to retire this embarrassment of a prize. The Guardian critic Laura Cumming gave it 2 stars out of 5, saying it's everything, everywhere, all at once. Is that a bad thing? I wonder. I feel like it takes some confidence to go against everyone, but here I go. I really like the Turner Prize show, even more so. I think it's one of the best I've ever seen. Granted, I was too young during the glitzy Hirst and Emin years, but I don't want glitz anyway. I want to take things seriously. I start by remembering that this isn't just a prize, but an exhibition. And the four artists are nominated for an exhibition. At Tate Britain this year, the artists mostly opted to recreate versions of the projects for which they were nominated. This means viewers get to see an impression of these four shows from the last year that the jury found meaningful and worthy of attention. The red 1980s Ford Ascot, covered in a doily, which has become the image most associated with this year's crop, featured in all those bleak reviews, is part of Jaslene Kaur's Alter Alter, which she showed at Tramway in Glasgow. It echoes a devotional space, with a carpet on the ground and a sky above. Actually, panels suspended from the ceiling that were painted a bluish-gray because it's supposed to be the Glasgow sky, above which Kaur placed objects like a football scarf, tape cassette player, and two bottles of Iron Brew. There's an automated harmonium that repeats the same hum constantly, like a mantra. It does feel like an altar, but a bit unclear to what. Like the old car with the white textile doily, it feels like a hybrid, an inexplicable image of how someone experiences life. There isn't a single explanation for what this is about. It's definitely personal, it's definitely about identity, but it's also about the specificity of these objects. That's because the objects that surround us are complex and heavily laden with histories. This is also the subject of Pio Abad's presentation, which brings together artifacts from the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, where the work was originally shown, with works he made to reflect on the history of his country of origin, the Philippines, and colonial heritage in Britain and elsewhere. There are huge sculptures in cement and bronze in the shape of jewelry. They reimagine an obscene bracelet made of rubies, diamonds, and pearls owned by Imelda Marcos, wife of Filipino dictator and kleptocrat Ferdinand Marcos, as well as a tiara she owned, which originally belonged to the Romanovs, was auctioned off by Stalin after their execution, and ended up in Imelda Marcos's collection. Abad uses the exhibition structure itself, telling these stories through the wall labels, adding a layer of knowledge to the objects which are already haunted by history. At an exhibition where so much is so conceptual, Delaine Labat's installation feels intensely different, handmade and all-encompassing. Labat, who is of Roma descent, isn't explaining or bridging any cultures here, instead creating a saturated installation that combines walls covered in aluminium foil with murals, drawings, music, and sculptures of dead flowers and ghostly characters. As viewers move through her space, it shifts from black and white and tinfoil to pastel colors, gauzy materials, and drawings on large loose papers, like one of a huge heart, not the emoji shape, the actual pump thing, as large as a whole chest, in green watercolor, next to a pink flamingo drawing. The lightness of these is not a tonic or a balm to the darkness of the rest of the installation. It's just part of this very inhabited world that's full of stories. At first encounter, Claudette Johnson's work would seem the most straightforward of the four. Her drawings and paintings are all portraits. Initially, I wondered if her presentation perhaps lacked the intense energy of Labat's and Kaur's work. And then I turned the corner. There, on a wall, is a huge painting on gesso, that crusty material used to prime canvases, of a Pietà. And it is so beautiful and so intense and so historical. It shows a black mother holding her adult child. Around the image swirls a text that still hurts me to read. Every mother was called when he called for his mother. Any mention of box ticking is shameful in an exhibition that includes a work like this. Proof that in a violent, difficult world, an artwork can still stun with emotion. And that's what matters. Maybe instead of the annual placing of bets and pearl clutching, but is it art? We should look at it like art. They say there can only be one winner, but what if you don't care who won? Instead, you can see the work. You won't lose anything by not placing a bet.
Orit Gat's voice notes there, and the Turner Prize exhibition runs at Tate Britain until the 16th of February 2025, if there's still a world by then, and the winner is announced on December 3rd, if there's even a world by then. gazing into the abyss now with the help of a two-hour BBC drama set in Sheffield, the 1984 retro TV classic Threads imagined a nuclear war that was then, as now, just around the corner, its bandaged face seeded the nightmares of a generation of impressionable youth, one of those being Tig O'Sullivan, as he remembers in his latest Mushroom Cloud of Unknowing.
The sound of a few hundred boys moving through a corridor. The sounds of doors opening, classrooms filling, chairs scraping. The sound of adult voices asking for and eventually getting quiet. The distant click of brisk heels on tiles, accompanied by one of the most joyous sounds of this time in my life. A trolley with a television and a VCR. The door of our classroom opens. Our religion teacher wheels the trolley in. The sound of a male voice. The sounds of life in Northern Britain. Young love, pubs, houses. The sounds of radios and televisions as background to this life. The sounds of war. Over the course of a double class, the film that we were shown was Threads, made by the BBC in 1984. The film is a portrait of the lead-up to, events of, and aftermath of a nuclear war, told entirely through the lives of people in the city of Sheffield. It's pretty devastating and gave me one of the most harrowing and most important days of my school years.
Thinking of getting engaged anyway.
It's a hell of a time to be starting a family in the middle of a recession.
Drawing on the heritage of British social realist films of the era, the first half of Threads tells the everyday story of two young lovers, an unplanned pregnancy, a quickly planned wedding, and the awkward class tensions arising from two families being thrown together by circumstance. In the background of these lives, a geopolitical crisis told in overheard radio and television reports.
The United States has hinted it may send troops to the Middle East if the Russians don't move their forces out of Iran.
An American-backed coup in Iran. A Soviet military response.
Our legitimate Western interest in the Middle East.
A standoff over oil fields. Red lines, deadlines, escalation, and then.
Jesus Christ.
The second half of the film is set in the grim aftermath. Death and destruction are everywhere. We follow some of the characters we met earlier through the rubble of the city, the rubble of their lives. Into radiation sickness, and more often than not, death. Society itself has collapsed. Martial law, looting. A sheep is killed, its meat eaten raw. The focus shifts slowly from the days and weeks after the bomb to the months and years beneath the grey skies of a nuclear winter. Our one surviving central character and her baby trudging ever onward in an unremittingly bleak Northern Britain. The child's father, the heart of the start of the film, has, like many other characters, simply disappeared. Also gone, never to be heard again, are those responsible. The British, the Soviet, and the American politicians, the voices of central government with their warnings and instructions, all have fallen silent. The people, those who are left, are on their own. The film's credits rolled in silence. A strange air hung over our class for the remainder of the day. All casual violence was quietly suspended. Not a single dead arm was administered. Nobody was shoved into a wall or tripped. A strange, frightened solidarity took hold. Today, the nuclear threat is just as present and real as it was when writer Barry Hines and director Mick Lynch made their famous work. Several nuclear powers are involved, directly and indirectly, in unpredictable, uncontrollable wars. Wars that, if you believe the voices of the powerful that fill the airwaves and form the background of our lives now, are necessary, inevitable, just. As with anti-capitalism, anti-war positions are largely marginal now. The positions of unserious, unrealistic people. War is the ambient background noise, the necessary engine hum of capitalism itself. It's next to impossible to imagine something like Threads being made today. Public service television has changed drastically. Any version of Threads now would likely seek to present both sides of the nuclear holocaust issue, perhaps featuring some insect or rodent characters for whom humanity's demise is something of a boon. The days of captive audiences are long gone too, and in the marketplace of ideas, such grim visions would be left squarely on the shelf. By the time I emerged, shook, from room L in Carlo CBS, the Cold War was over. The initial wave of euphoria and optimism that greeted the triumph of capitalism had faded, and uncertainty had taken hold. It was a period to which one might have applied Gramsci's observation from 1929. The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. A few short years later, however, the new order was so unassailable that Frederick Jemison noted that it was easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And yet we don't imagine. The images of horror that we see daily, on the news, on our phones, seem to bypass the imagination. We are seeing, constantly seeing, but failing to imagine. We fail to imagine the reality that is being lived through by so many people already in those parts of the world where climate and war make death a daily reality and life barely livable. We fail to imagine a world in which the new threads that connect us, the digital and electronic threads that are largely privatized, monetized, and entrusted to business, could be broken. We fail to imagine a truly human solidarity that will be needed when the voices of the powerful fall silent.
Tygo Sullivan's Cloud of Unknowing there. And finally, this time on the Culture File Weekly, Paddy Woodworth runs his thumbs across the spines all the way along the shelf to Windfall, an anthology of Irish nature poetry gathered by the poet Jane Clark and, as Paddy points out now, in the latest edition of the Naturalist Bookshelf, notably charged with the work of illustrator Jane Carkill.
There is an easily pleasing way to compile an anthology of Irish nature poetry. After all, many of our best-known and most obviously distinguished poets have left us a rich legacy of fine nature poems. Think of Seamus Heaney, perhaps especially of Michael Longley, of Patrick Kavanagh and W.B. Yeats. You could reap a rich crop from stellar writers like these. Throw in a few personal favourites by lesser-known poets, and you would have a very marketable book. But the editor of the book we are taking off our shelf this evening, Jane Clark, who is herself recently established as a most accomplished nature poet, is never one to take the easy road. In Windfall, Irish Nature Poems to Inspire and Connect, she has, of course, included work by all the above familiar names. But she has limited all contributions to a single work per poet, and she has created her anthology from deep and broad and thoughtful research, putting alongside them poems by many writers who are lesser known, and several who have been so unfairly forgotten that they will be completely new to many readers. At least, they were certainly new to me. And it comes as no surprise, unfortunately, given the misogynist blind spot in so much Irish publishing, that many of these overlooked writers are women. There is another way in which Clark's stimulating representation of the canon of our nature poetry departs from the well-trodden paths. The poems she chooses do not necessarily have nature as their explicit theme, but the natural world is always woven strongly, if subtly, into their broader fabric. And isn't this just the way many of us experience nature in our actual lives? Not always central, but never completely absent, and often informing our feelings in ways we only half recognise. This is true, for example, of the heartbreakingly beautiful elegy, Dead, by Winifred M. Letts, where a bird's song and a wren's nest are just some of the foolish idle things that recall a lost beloved to the grieving poet. But they are deeply significant ones, and they make her grief more universal, less purely personal, than the other things that remind her of him. There are far too many luminous and telling poems in this collection to even mention here, so I will pick out just a few that particularly caught my imagination. There are some interesting aspects. How, for example, the word dark quietly links three adjacent poems. Here is Sean Hewitt on picking wild garlic at night in its woodland habitat. I turn home, and all across the floor, the spiked white flowers light the way. The world is dark, but the wood is full of stars. And here is Frieda Lawton's Now Linnet, so musically echoing the spring season. Skies grow tender as they hear the lark strip one by one the scales of dark. And finally, Mark Roper's haunting vision of the barn owl by day, when he sees it as a feathered flask where mouse and vole are silently rendered. No good, the sun knocking at our door. Only dark knows how to open her wings. I also particularly savoured Martin Dyer's evocation of hill-walking, a Merlin in the Sheffries. Jane Clark's own scientifically precise but stirring hymn to nature restoration, Recipe for a Bog, Francis Harvey's brilliant portrayal of a heron, and Eamon Grennan's characteristically challenging Trees Abiding. Foremost for me, at first reading and still today, is John Hewitt's The Watchers. This poem uncannily captures the experience of hours spent waiting to observe a badger while unobserved, and the elusive, broader epiphany the one-way encounter finally gives him. It was as if another nature came close to my knowledge, but could not be known. Yet if I tried to call it by its name, would start, alarmed, and instantly be gone. This diverse collection, where every page calls forth reflection and meditation, is linked by themes like birds, woods and trees, and the garden. But it is more intimately linked by the luminous illustrations of Jane Carkle, which stream across page after page, often spilling across a centre spread. These images are as lovingly true to the plants and animals they evoke as they are to the imaginative vision of the poets whose words they are inspired by. This collection is a quiet triumph of collaboration between two truly remarkable talents. Clark's insightful and daring selections and juxtapositions, and Carkle's exquisitely delicate but vivid painting. Together, they further enhance the beauty and wisdom of the works that comprise it through their evident empathy with each poem and poet from start to finish.
Paddy Woodworth there, putting up on the shelf Windfall, edited by Jane Clark and illustrated by Jane Carkill. And Jane Carkill is one of the panel for the Culture File debate on nature illustration called Seeing Natures, which, along with another Culture File debate session, Winged Muses, on authors and their favourite birds, takes place at the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin on November 9th as part of Dublin Book Festival. Tickets for both are free from dublinbookfestival.ie. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more audio illustrations on the radio and in your podcast places next week. Till then, bye now.